lesson to be learned, and one that we must never forget if we wish to maintain paid-up insurance policies against our drinking. You recall the story about Bill having had some spiritual experience, having been sold on the idea of attempting to be helpful to others. You undoubtedly recall the fact that he had been working quite hard at it for around 5 months or so, almost incessantly, and still had not created, if you please, a single convert. Not one. As we expected, no one had jailed. But he had worked tirelessly. There was no thought of saving his own strength or time or anything. But nothing seemed to register. When he came off to Akron on this business mission, which perhaps for the good of all of us turned out to be quite a flop, although he had to think late but didn't know it, he was tempted to go. He was pacing up and down the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, wondering whether he better buy those two pieces of gin and be king for a night, as he expected it, or not. And his teachings led him to believe that he possibly might avoid getting into difficulties if he found some alcoholic on whom to work. Spying the name of our good friend Reverend Walters on the bulletin board in the lobby of the Mayflower, he called up the good doctor and asked him the names of some of the groups of people with whom he had been affiliated and through whose instrumentality he had acquired sobriety. The doctor said he wasn't one, but he knew of quite a number, and he gave him quite a little list, I guess about 9 or 10 of them. So Bill starts to call them up. Without very much success, they had either just left town, or they were just leaving town, or they were having a party, or they had a short call or something. Anyway, they came down to the end, or at least very nearly the end, and they were eyes light on the name Mr. and happened to get our good friend Henry Etter. And he called up on good Henry and told her what he wanted, and she said, "Come right out and have lunch with him." So out he went and went into his story in considerable detail, and she said, "I have just the man for you." So she rushes to the farm and calls up him and tells her that she has just the power to be helpful to Bob, and we should come over. And he said, "Well, I guess we better not go today." But Henry is very persistent, very determined individual. He said, "Oh yes, tomorrow. I know I'll be helpful to Bob." Well, Henry didn't think it quite wise for us to come over today. And finally, Henry bore in to such an extent that she had to tell her that I was very much in the sack. And has in fact surpassed all the capabilities for listening to any conversation, and it would just possibly have to be postponed. So she talked to him the next day, having invited being Sunday on Mother's Day, and we said that Ann said we would be over. Well, I don't ever remember feeling much worse, but being very fond of Henry and having said we'd go over, we started over, and I extracted a sound promise from him on the way over that 15 minutes of this stuff was passed. But I didn't want to talk with this mug or anybody else, and we'd really make it snappy. Now, due to actual fact, we got there at 5 o'clock, and it was 11:15 when we left. Now, you know, probably your memories are good enough to carry you back to certain times when you haven't felt too good, and you can easily visualize the fact that you wouldn't have listened to anybody unless that individual had really had something to tell you. And that's the way I felt about Bill. And I recognized the fact that he did have something, and so I listened those many hours. And I stopped drinking immediately. But very shortly after that, there was a medical meeting in Atlantic City. And I developed a terrific thirst for knowledge. I had to have knowledge. So I would go to Atlantic City and absorb lots of knowledge. I usually mention the fact that I incidentally had acquired a thirst for scotch, but I didn't mention that. But anyway, I went to Atlantic City and really hung one on. And when I was turned to, I was in the home of a friend of ours in Chicago Falls, one of our suburbs. And Bill came over and got me and got me home. Gave me a hooker or two of scotch that night and a bottle of beer the next morning. And that was on the 10th of June of 35, and I have had no alcohol in any form that I know of since. Now, the interesting part of all this, and not all these sordid details, but the condition that we two fellows were in, we had both been associated with the same bunch of people. He in New York and I in Akron. I had been associated with them, in fact, for 2 years and a half. He for 5 months. He had acquired this idea of service, and that I had not. But I had done an immense amount of reading, which they recommended. I had refreshed my memory on the good book, and I had an excellent training in that as a youngster. They told me that I should go to their meetings regularly, and I did every week. They said I should affiliate myself with some church, and we did that. And they also said that I should cultivate the habit of prayer. And I did that, or at least to quite a considerable extent for me. But I got thanked every night. And I mean that, there was so much going on, I was practically every night. And I couldn't understand what was wrong. I had done all these things that these good people told me to do. Every one of them, and I thought very faithfully and sincerely, but I still continued to overindulge. But the one thing that they hadn't told me was the one thing that Bill had. The instruction to attempt to be helpful to somebody else. So we immediately started to look around for prospects, and it wasn't long before one appeared in the form of a man whom you all know. At least a great many of you know, our good friend, Rick Hacken. I knew that this girl was a Sunday school superintendent. And I also thought that he probably forgot more about the good book every night than I ever do. And yet, who would I be trying to tell him about it? And so, made me feel somewhat hypocritical. It is quite a job for me to talk to him on that sort of subject. But anyway, we both did, and I'm very glad to say the conversation fell on fertile ground. Then in October, we had three dumped in our laps, almost simultaneously. But the point I wanted to bring out was the fact that that in my mind the spirit of service is of prime importance, although it has to be backed up with some knowledge of the subject. I know I used to go to the hospital and I'd stand there and talk. I talked many a time to a chap in the bed for 4, 5, or 6 hours. I don't know how he ever stood me for 5 or 6 hours, but he did. Probably he didn't struggle or something. But anyway, it came to my mind that I probably didn't know too much about what I was talking. Therefore, we being the stewards of what we have, and that includes our time, I was not giving a good account of my stewardship of time. If it took me 6 hours to say something to this man that I could have said in an hour, we'll say, if I'd known what I was talking about, I certainly was not a very efficient individual. And incidentally, I'm somewhat allergic to work anyway. So, I felt that I should continue to increase my familiarity not only with the good book, but read a good deal of good standard literature and possibly something of scientific interest along with it. So I did follow the habit of reading. I think I'm not exaggerating when I say that I have probably averaged 3 an hour a day for the last 15 years. I don't say that to try to sell you on the idea that you've got to tolerate that habit of reading an hour a day. Because there are plenty of people in fine AAs that don't read very much. You see, back in those days, we were walking in the dark entirely. We did not know much about it. We knew practically nothing of alcoholism. I, a physician, knew nothing about it to speak of. Oh, I'd read about it, but there wasn't anything worth reading in any textbook. And usually the information about it consisted on for DT, it's on that fire, and if you have not why you prescribe it, you bromide, and give the fellow a good lecture. None of which, of course, amounted to very much. And in early AA days, we became quite convinced that the spiritual program was fine, but we could help them out and have a little some supplementary diet. So, in the early days, still having a lot of stomach trouble, I stumbled across the fact that he got along much better on sauerkraut and cold tomatoes. And so we thought that he was much as good to have that experience that probably everyone else would share the same. But of course we discovered later that the most any dietary restriction had very little to do with a some things kicked off. No matter we started in on self, we had no self-self, we had no traditions, we had nothing of that kind. But we were convinced that the answer to our problem was in the good book. And it became somewhat evident, we thought, to some of the older ones that it was contained, the part that we found absolutely essential to a rather limited section of the good book. In other words, the Sermon on the Mount, 15th chapter of Corinthians, and the book of James. I think we got those ideas pretty firmly implanted in our mind very early. And we had in those days our membership just of 5 and 7 and 10 and so small. My leaders had daily meetings in somebody's house. It was probably providentially arranged that this all this happened at a time when everybody was broke. And awfully broke, too. It was probably much easier for us to be successful when broke than it would have been to have been successful if we had a good checking account apiece. And I know that we were, every one of us, just were painfully broken. Well, it wasn't a pleasant thought. But nothing could be done about it, and everybody else was broke too, and so we didn't take it too much to heart. But I do think that that was providential arrangement. Well, anyway, we kept on having these meetings and having these discussions and attending the meetings of the people with whom we have been associated, and we continue to have them with them until, in Akron I'm talking about, of course, until about 40, or maybe early in 41, not even January 49, I don't recall exactly. When we outgrew the old bench of this good friend who allowed us to bang up the classroom and the door jam with the counting chairs up and down, then we had a very beautiful home. We had outgrown that, and so we shut out. And in a short time, the crowd, the rental of the auditorium in the King School, and I'm talking about the group of our temperament, I didn't have a sense. We attempt to have a good meeting, and I think we're usually successful. But it wasn't until 39 that the teachings and efforts and studies that had been going on were crystallized in the form of the 12 steps. I didn't write the 12 steps, they have nothing to do with the writing of them. I think probably I had something to do with them indirectly, because after this June 10th episode, Bill came to live at our house and stayed for about 3 months. And there was hardly a night in that 3 months that we didn't sit up till 2 or 3 o'clock discussing these things. And it would be hard for me to conceive that something wasn't said during those nightly discussions around our kitchen table that influenced the actual writing of the 12 steps. Much more handy, but in that form, of course, we had the ideas pretty much basically, but not in the first and tangible form. We get them, as I said, as a result of our study in this one out of the good book. We must have had them because we have had some experience that they are very important in maintaining sobriety, and we were maintaining sobriety. That's all we had them, but not in the exactly the written form as you know them now. But that was the way that things started out in Africa. And as we grew, I thought we began to get offshoots. First one was in Cuban, and I don't remember the next one, but anyway, they started in Akron not too long after that, and have been continuing ever since. It was great self satisfaction to me to feel that I may have had some path in taking in my two bits work of getting this thing started. I like to think that I have done that. Maybe I'm taking too much for granted, I don't know. But I feel that I was simply used as God's agent. I feel that I'm no different from any of you fellows or girls, except that I was a little more fortunate that I got this message 15 and a half years ago, and some of you have to wait till a little later. In fact, I got a little teased that I am following the charity a little slow on the trail because I thought I would have been ready to receive it quite a while before he got around. And that used to irritate me no end, but after all, maybe he knows better than I. Well, I'm not sure that I would have been glad to have anything presented that would have been workable and produced the sobriety which I thought at least that I wanted for better. I used to even doubt that at times. I was going to my good friend Henry and say, Henry, do you think that I want to stop drinking with us? Henry, being very sharp, looked over at you and said, Bob, I'm sure you want to stop. And I would say, well, I can't conceive of any living human who really wanted to do something as badly as I think I wanted to do it, who could be so total a failure. But anyway, I think I'm just one of these wander guys. He said, Mom, I think you wander. We just haven't found the way to work it yet. But anyway, that was the way I thought about it. And besides, it reminded me that the body has been maintained continuously for a few and a half years. It doesn't allow me to think that I'm necessarily any farther away from my next drink than any of you people here. I'm still very human, and I still think that a double shot would take much good. And if it didn't produce the rest of the results, I might do it. I don't know. I really don't know. But I have no reason to think that it would taste any different. I have no legitimate reason to believe that the results would be any different. They were always the same. They were always the same in that I always wound up back to the dear old baseball summer. I have no precedent or anything to make it feel legitimate for me to believe that the results today would be any different than they were 14 and 20 and 25 and 30 years ago when I did the same thing. I just don't want to say that to you. So that's a big deal. It always was, and I think it would be even louder today, because of what has gone on in the last 15 years. I'm naturally being a bit out of practice. I don't believe I'd really last very long. And I'm of extreme carelessness and indifference. I said I was quite human. And I get reflecting every once in a while, if it's a dying, terrifying individual, he suffers with a depression like the betrayal. Thank you. You know, after that thing, it almost hours if you chuck it into a chapel. Now we got to take that absolute honesty, surely, unselfishness, and love, and whatever your decision is, sets up pretty well with all four. Your answer can't be very far out of the way. If however you do that, as I have done at times, and still am not too satisfied with the answer, I usually consult some friend whose judgment perhaps I think in this particular case would be very much better than mine. But usually you can do it yourself without bothering your friends about your own personal decision. In overcoming the first step, can't quite get honest enough to admit that John Dry, John Ray, has bested us. Not at all school charity, somewhat like it, with charity of ideas and charity of motives and what have you. Non-selfishness includes those things that I've just been talking about, not the dime or the 2 bits to the bump, but actually giving of yourself. And as you all know, the absolute love is probably a big word in property, and I'll show you a little bit more along with it. I think that that is a very difficult thing to have. Absolutely. I don't think any of us will ever get it. But that doesn't mean that we can't try to get it. It is extremely difficult for me, and I feel that I never have been very successful at it. It's very difficult for me to learn my partner. I didn't dislike him, but I didn't love him. Unless there was some special reason, he was just, I was just indifferent toward it. I was doing any harm. I would be willing to give him a little lift if it didn't require too much effort. I never would injure him at all. But to love him, I just couldn't do it for a long time. And I think that I owe him that to some extent. And I was forced to do it. Because I was even going around this court and not to attempt to be helpful to him, I would probably get sentenced. We could say, that's just a manifestation of selfishness. Which is quite correct. I was selfish with the extent of not wanting suicide. So to keep from getting suicide, I would attempt to go through the motions of being helpful to this person. You can debate it any way you want to, but the fact still remains that the average individual, absolute love is a thing that he will never acquire. I suspect there are a few people who do. I think maybe I know some that come pretty close to it. But I think I could count them on the fingers of one hand. I don't say that in a disparaging manner. That's a wonderful friend. I'm talking about it in its common aspect and particularly as it applies to AIDS. I don't think we do anything well very much in this world unless we practice it. And I don't think we do any good too well unless we practice it. So we started with when break world records and athletic events for people who win titles in the boxing arena. Now, people who practice it, they've been practicing it for years. Even though they may necessarily be endowed with a lot of physical ability and skill, they still have to practice. And we have to practice to do a good job in the age. And there are a number of things that we should practice. There's some practices I pray, acquiring the spirit of service. We should attempt to acquire some faith, which isn't always easy done, especially for the person who's always been very materialistically minded. And as I understand it, this society today, beyond all doubt, and peradventure. You have $1 million, and your neighbor has $900,000, you're a much better man than your neighbor, to the extent of $100,000. And so forth and so on, I have no feeling. But, I think that it can be acquired. It can be acquired slowly. I don't really, I think that is something that has to be cultivated also. That was not easy for me. I just assume it's difficult for others. Another thing that was difficult for me, and I probably don't do too well yet, and that is the matter of power. Well, I will give time to have closed minds. They're pretty tightly closed, probably. And that's one reason that some people find spiritual teaching difficult. They don't want to find out too much about it. For various personal reasons. One reason is the fear of being considered a dominant. But anyway, the matter of powers toward the other individual's ideas, it's quite important that we do acquire it. I think I've acquired it. I have much more of it than I did have. Well, not enough to help me any yet. Somebody taught me why I would have to make at least a rather toxic remark about it, which I've done many times, much to my regret. And later on I found that the man knew much more about it than I, and I've been instantly better off if I just shut my big mouth shut. Another thing with which most of us are not over blessed, and that is the dealing with humility. I don't mean the humility in the sense of Dickens, you're a heap of power. I don't mean the drawing up variety. I don't think we're necessarily called on to be shut down and stepped on by anyone, and we have a right to stand up for our rights. I'm talking about the attitude of each and every one of us spread out in the closet. I said of myself, I am nothing. My thanks come from my Father alone. And if you had to say that, how about you and me? But did you say it? Did I say it? No. That's exactly what we didn't say. We were in time to say, well, look at those boys, please shut up. That type of attitude. But there's no humility. No sense of having received anything to raise your own desire. For if I accomplish something, either in AA activity, or socially, or in my profession, I don't believe I have any right to get cocky about it. Only through God's grace if I do it. I can feel very thankful that I was privileged to do it, to have the recognition which I knew I received from my privilege. But basically, it was only through His kindness. And my strength does come from Him, and these things come as a result of His kindness. Who am I to get cocky about it? I should have a very, very humble attitude toward the source of my strength. And I should also never cease to be grateful for whatever dream of success. Whether they're drinking liquor or whether they are not, they're still after the same thing, and that's happiness and peace of mind.
Third step, we turn our life and our will over to God, on this direction our exterior. My spirit murder said word any time I would take no more. It came nearly to that point in a few cases. But thank God, and the certain prayers of, well, I suppose many of the sisters who were interested, and our beloved Dr. Baum, and Bill himself, somehow we weathered it through. I'll just do ask me to say a few words about how we got started in Athens. I hardly know myself. I was sent there in 1928, just as it might be the doctor recommended occupational therapy. Changed occupation for a while. I was in the field of music, and as you know, that's rather nerve-wracking. And, I was sent to St. Thomas, which was just opened in 1928. And it was there I met Dr. Bob. We had movement staff the first year because we didn't know the men, nor did they know us. The doctor operated at our hospital and the other hospitals. I didn't know they had a drinking problem, and in fact, I wouldn't have known it had he not told me so, because he didn't come to the hospital when he was drinking, evidently. Oh, I can recall sometimes his voice was rather reverberating. I could hear him when he came in the back door. He had a decided English accent, I mean New England accent. But I liked him because he's so straightforward. Those of us working on hospitals know that some doctors make everything an emergency, a matter of life or death. Others will tell you the exact truth about the case. Say, well, my patient waited a few days, or if they can't, then you know that you take them for what they say. However, the doctor is so straightforward, I enjoyed working with him. And one day he looked rather down. We often had little chats. And this morning he came and looked rather down. I said, "Doctor, what's the trouble this morning?" Well, then he told me. He said, "Well, sister," he said, "I might as well tell you that I came in contact with a New York broker and that had a drinking problem for a long time, and somehow we got together and we all tried to work out something that will help these drunks," he said. Well, he said, "We've been trying it out. They tried a few rest homes, and we had some in the other hospitals." And he said, "Sister, would you consider taking one?" Well, I hesitated because sometime before, probably some months before, I took a man in who always looked, I didn't know much about this drinking. I mean, some could drink, and some could drink and handle it well, and others couldn't. So they called me to the emergency, and I went down and talked with him. Oh, he said, "Just like just lie down a little while." He worked at the city garage and looked like a very respectable person. He said, "I've been drinking a little too much, and I want a little bit right now," which I thought was a good thing. Well, the only bed that we had at the time was a bed in the four-bedroom. Then we knew nothing about special treatments. And I signed to the man on service, on medical service, and registered him, put him to bed, and I said, "You won't cause any trouble." "Oh, no, he'd be an angel." Well, I forgot about him. When I came over early the next morning, the night supervisor, who was tall, sister,
We don't seem to run a lot of big teeth.
Well, she was standing at the store waiting for me. She said, the next time you take a DT in this place, please stay up all night and run around after him as we have. That wasn't the end of it either. I decided then that's enough. I often felt sorry to see them turned away, but I was not the last word in the hospital. Someone got to propose my taking a real look. I told him about this experience, and I said, Doctor, I'm not only, well, I get put out, but I said, the patients and everything else, I said, I don't think they want alcoholics. He said, sister, this patient won't give you this trouble, because I will medicate him, I'll assure you. Well, I had no confidence in him because he never said anything that wasn't so. I'll always say that. Well, very carefully, I said, well, Doctor, I shall take him then. And we put him in a two-bedroom. I thought I was doing pretty well because we were so crowded in those days. And beds were rather premium. So I took him in this two-bedroom. Doctor went up and medicated him and everything. And I thought, well, I figured I wouldn't hear much till the next morning anyway. There wasn't any trouble. So, well, there was a word about it. The doctor then came to the admission office. Thank you. He said, sister, would you mind putting my patient in a private room? I thought I had done pretty good to put him in a two-bed. He said, you know, he said there'll be some men come to visit him, and they'd like to talk to him privately. Well, I said, I'll do what I can, doctor. After he left, I went up and looked the situation over. And right across the hall, we had a flower room where we used to prepare the patient's flowers. And I thought, well, they can fix their fire somewhere else for today, and I believe I could push the bed in there. That's what we did. And his visitors came. We kept a close eye on them. Looking men, they don't know that they ever took a drink. And went along. I thought, now the next time, I won't have this trouble, and I'll put him in a private room. So the next one that came along, I put him in a private room. And I didn't know much about these alcoholics. I was not an expert, surely. The Lord picked out a weakling when he picked out me, I know. But, however, I took him down to the room, as I would any patient, and then was taking the chart to the desk to explain to the nurse a little about it. I couldn't tell her too much. I said Dr. Bob would give her the orders. And was he down after me? Well, he had his short tongue and everything else. I nearly went through the floor because the nurse was all looked and Evans. And you go back to that room and do it right now. So the nurse came down with me. And here he was under the bed. Well, I thought this will never work. This will go at all. I better put two together. The next time. I didn't want to give up at once. I don't know just exactly what I did, whether I had someone stay with him or what I did. But I know after that, I put two together and then finally took a four-bedroom
That's going to go pretty good. One would help the other. Usually, one or two of you in a few days before they'd be coming out of it pretty well. And, so then we put another two bed across the hall. Well, it was hard to say no when they really wanted to do something about it. And by that time, men were coming in quite often. Some of the sisters said, who are these fine looking men that come in so often and seem so interested in the patients? And I didn't say much at first, but later I said, well, that is AA. I said, what is AA? Would you like to know something about it? Well, yes. Well, I'll bring some literature. But of course, before that, a committee from Alcoholics Anonymous talked with Sister Superior. She was one who had a lot of experience in the old days of charity and all. And she knew what we were doing. And she said to these men, she said, well, strange, she said, when we had them at charity, they'd be running around in the hall and having a lot of trouble. But since Dr. Bob is treating them, we don't know that they're in the house. So she said, there's no problem. If I buy the seed, just go right along. Well, that's a fun thing. But that wasn't all. Of course, then later the patients complained because they didn't have visitors at any time. If these AAs did, they seemed like such privileged characters. So finally, they decided to, we had a small accident warning. It was started off in the rest of the hospital. And there we put in the coffee bar and Dr. Bob set up the program. I want to tell you that the first opportunity he had, he brought Bill over. And, of course, I couldn't imagine who this wonderful Bill was. But I soon learned that God had chosen two great men. What one didn't have, the other supplemented. And together, they were perfect. I could just see, I often say to our boys, had John Chicago two great religious leaders, no one would have come near them, because the alcoholic doesn't want anything about religion or God, nor do we try to preach religion to them. But they aren't in very long until they're asking, or telling them what experience they've had and what they'd like to do. They know they haven't been living right. And I feel that, as many of our nurses have said, the best set of it is peace of mind. At once, they can be relieved of their anxieties and worries and treated properly. There should be no trouble. First, when we first came in and the doctor set up the program, no televisions, no radios, no newspapers. Only literature pertaining to AA or something that would have a moral ability in their morals and things of that kind. Because they don't, they have all the reading they can take care of, and then their visitors, too. Well, we went on with that. There's so many details I could bring in, but I don't want to make it too long because I know many of you have probably questions that maybe Colonel Thomas could answer some of these people who know much more than I. But anyway, during Dr.'s time, I think we treated for between 4,000 and 5,000. And he treated them, he came in every day unless he was out of town or something like that. And without any charge, he said, that's my contribution to AA. Of course, in those days, they didn't have too much either to start with. You couldn't mention money very well for how much it would cost, because if we just kept them sober, it would be a great deal. But that was taken care of later on. Thank God. It worked out very well. And there are no problems. Oh, many times, whether they have it or don't, we take them in, because God certainly provides. And a man who gets his soul is everlastingly grateful. Doctors, it was hard to understand Sometimes you make rounds and they come down and say, Sister, look at him and go home. He doesn't want this room. Oh, but down here has a big family and he has to cut me up. Doesn't want the room, he says. He wasn't ready. So he was always right. Many times they frightened me with that they had a heart attack, or they would tell me they had a bad heart or something. And I hate it to bother a doctor too much. Often I call Ann. I think members of this group or any alcoholic should often say a prayer for Ann. If she was the backbone of this, in her calm, quiet way, she was really an angel. I would call and say, oh, Ann, I'm so worried about this fellow. She knew most of them from either reputation or doctor telling about them. And she would get the doctor if it was anything serious, but otherwise did not. Don't worry about them. Because, they're alcoholics, in other words. Take them at once. That was doctor's plan too. I thought, oh my, that's her restricted me. Oh, I see the wisdom of it. Because if there is a merry-go-round, when that temptation comes, you know, I think, well, I can get back in there for 5 or 6 days. Well, that'd be all right. Sister's good. She'll take me back. And I'd only encourage them by drinking. They know that it's a one-way trip. The sponsors, and as Colonel Pound said, they are. Their cooperation is tremendous. Any hospital who tries to just take them in on their own is very foolish because they need the sponsorship. I often say it's something like learning the technique of golf. You may know all the angles and all the rules, but unless you get out there in the field and do some footwork and practice, you won't be much of a golfer. So we tried, Dr. Selfish, they could be taken on the environment. At first, it was just 5 days because people were pretty depleted after the depression and all, and financially. And the sooner we got them back to their family, the better. Although many of those first A's would take them into their own homes and try to help indoctrinate them. They worked in groups. It was none of us what they did. But however, we certainly have found that it was very wise because the sponsor will not bring them until they are ready. And then he screens them carefully and goes over it. We want to be sure that sponsor is not just a person they met in the bar somewhere. One way you could ask them what groups they're attending, of course, now I know most of them well, you know, who are the sponsors and who are not. But it's a tremendous help. So finally, the time came, well, as Anne, of course, died in 49, and that was very hard for doctors. He called in the premier, of course, they had just gotten in from Texas, and the plane was found, it wasn't true. Bill knows more about this than I. Anyway, they brought his record to the hospital, and we kept doctor there, too, because he was pretty well shaken up with all this. And Ann died of pneumonia and all that. So, went on to marry a doctor, then died in 1950, a year and a half later. He knew then, I believe, that he had an emergency. He had talked with Bill, well, I think that several times a week, if not every other day, he gave me a message. And I felt as though I knew Bill and his guiding spirit, too, because there wasn't very much done that they didn't consult together on. that to anything affecting this, the foundation of this. Then, one day I got worried. We're just like people in the army, you know, we go to where we're sent. I often wondered whether I was off the mailing list or what, I was forgotten. I was there 24 years. Probably 1 week short of 24 years. And finally, the obedience came. So I was going to charity and worked with AA there. They haven't had AA charity and fine workers there, but they just had a small department. And Sister Victorine, a very fine sister who everybody loved, was there too. And she came down and we told her everything, and Dr. Bob talked with her. And she really did a good job. But they decided to build a new wing and all the extra. Oh, I know they thought the Alcoholics Anonymous was a thrill, then or not, but everything was discontinued. It wasn't absolutely a case of life or death. So they just kind of forgot about AA. But then my mother didn't. She saw much good in it, I know. I went there in August, and I didn't hear a word about, other than on my obedience, it said that I was to take care of this floor and visit these patients and work with AA. Oh, I knew someday maybe we'd have them. But anyway, I just observed and went along day by day. Finally, one day, I got a call. I was in surgery checking on the patient to see if I'm not the condition. Now we were worried about this patient, and the bell rang furiously, and the superior wants to see on your floor. And I came down, and the architect of the new building was there, and a few nurses, the director of our nursing service was there, and the superior said, "What kind of a setup would you like for this AA?" Well, you imagine standing in the middle of the floor and feeling rather strange. I didn't want to call myself or not just yet. And I couldn't think very fast. So this nurse said, "Well, sister, are they violent?" I said, "No, they're not violent. Oh, they're not intoxicated." "Yes, they are intoxicated. But they're clear enough to be screened because we must make sure that they want the person." "Well," she said to the architect, "you won't need those papers then." "Well," I said, "Mr. Washington, would you mind giving me a few days and we'll drop a little plan of what we'd like?" "Fine." Well, the day that they came was on Peach Park, Ladies of Rosary, that's how we call it, Rosary Hall. And there is a connected with that, when I was moved there, I thought, "Oh, I'd love to have this in memory of Dr. Bob." Well, I thought if I get permission there and call it the Alcoholic Ward, we'll call it Rosary Hall. And I was thinking of marking that Rose R.H. Well, I thought all I need is a mess, and I have got this initial, R.H.S. Robert Holbrook Smith. So we call it Rosary Hall for Larry. Insignia on the door is RHS. Permission to open the wall is granted by a hospital, the hospital authorities on October 7th, 1952. Peace and Most Holy Rosary. I feel that the people, whether they're in the church or out, whatever the denomination, when you see a rosary, you know it means prayer. If you forget the rosary out, well, you think they're praying somehow. So to everyone, I think this is all a result of someone's prayer. The grace of God comes through someone's prayer and penance, that's for sure. Or anyway, the sheriff ought to name Rosary Hall, Solarium. Well, I told you about that. The insignia eloquently expresses the efforts of the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine, a Catholic religious order, as they join forces with the members of AA, a strictly non-sectarian movement, in an attempt to rescue men and women of all creeds from the bottomless pit of alcoholism. To be admitted to this ward, you must be sponsored by a member of AA in good standing. You must also evidence the desire not just to get sober, but also preserve and perpetuate your sobriety on a day-by-day basis. Unless you yourself are willing to admit that you are an alcoholic, you are advised to seek help elsewhere. The physical therapy, most modern known to medical science. The patient's entire stay is a retirement from the outside world, and the habits of this have caused his collapse. There are no radios, televisions, newspapers, and magazines. Nothing but AA literature and other literature in keeping with the problems are available. The patient may have no visitors except members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who are welcome between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. The conversation turns alcoholism and its ravaging problems. Every evening, a member of AA comes to the hospital to conduct a brief AA meeting for the patient. And the staff across the car stands in the center of the hall where AA members and the patients often gather to discuss their common problems. A little oratory is open at all times. Just if they want, do some prayerful thinking. There. The remodeling and construction work that is hilariously done by members of AA who consider their time and money. Members who belong to the building trade work day and night during these spare hours to complete the lovely quarters at no cost to the hospital. Audrey Hall accepted its first person 1 year ago, and since that date, 1,000 men and women have been hospitalized therein. We have much room for women. We're hoping to get more. Oh, we have three. We have three. Sometimes four, and even stretched to five. But that isn't good. However, Rosie Hall accepted his first case 1 year ago, and since that date, well, pardon me for repeating, they have been offered not only the key to sobriety, but also the key to a happy sobriety. The Sisters of Charity and members of Alcoholics Anonymous who had assisted them decline any individual credit. They are aware that it is in giving we receive. Well, God bless you all, and I wish you a continued happy sobriety. And may God's grace be with you always and bless every one of you. Thank you.
This recording of Joe Lesson was transferred from a record to the tape. You've got to an open meeting here, April 1947. Thanks.
There are two ways of looking at Alcoholics Anonymous. To our friends seated here among us, Alcoholics Anonymous doubtless seems a huge and spectacular success. They may be thinking of us as the people who have won great personal victory by fighting great odds. But everyone in this audience knows his friends give him so much credit that in actuality, his recovery did not happen that way at all. Each in his heart knows that he became too weak to fight alone, that he had to confess his life had become unmanageable, and therefore unbearable. He remembers how his power of will to conquer alcohol was crushed, how he finally saw he could never win through under his own strength. Nevertheless, he will tell you that this bitter admission, the hardest a human being can make, was the beginning of his new life, that new life of which this needed. Is such a glowing and grateful testimony. Since no AA meeting can ever be a burst of personal victory, it is, instead, our humble demonstration of that saving grace which all of us have found in a simple reliance on a power greater than ourselves. But, our friends may object, isn't it contrary to most human experience nowadays? Each of you puts the fight. You form in a group, then you help each other. Meanwhile, depending upon some higher power. We admit it works, we assume it's true. Still, your philosophy doesn't entirely make sense. How can you win wars without fighting battles? Nowadays, when almost everybody feels he must fight, even to survive, here is the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous telling us, just bring to the whole world that in their experience they have found a new life only by first admitting they could not personally control the old, let alone managing anything or anybody else. By what strange paradox, then, has this new strength arisen out of your bygone weakness? Once out of complete defeat comes your astounding transformation. Explain, if you can, the secret of this seeming contradiction, this divine paradox. These are the very natural questions of those who first observe us. Intuitively, our friends think the most. Most of them feel they have seen a miracle. For so powerful has been the alcoholic obsession that all through the ages, few victims have ever survived. Now comes this wholesale liberation, thousands every month. Was this miracle of recovery due only to the fact that we alcoholics have gotten together, telling each other that we are sick, advising each other to take in more suffering, and exhorting each other to be more honest and callous? Is that all there is to it? Have we only constructed one more psychological garden, this time operated by the patient, rather than the doctor? Few people who have taken a good look at AA believe this to be the full explanation. 10 years ago, a prominent physician was asked to explain Alcoholics Anonymous to a group of his colleagues. Said he, upon declining the invitation, "These old A's have assembled many powerful psychological resources. Yet the sum total of these resources does not explain to me the results I have witnessed. In days and weeks, I have seen unbelievable changes in their behavior and motivation. Changes in alcoholics which formerly, if at all possible, should have taken years at best. I can only say this. There is a power at work among these people for which I cannot account. I have to call it the X factor. Most AAs call it God. I have no scientific explanation for this mystery. Like our friend the doctor, any AA will also admit that he cannot fully explain the inner mystery of his own transformation. He can only tell the story of it as best he can, so that others may, if they wish, find their own freedom. Mine is a simple tale to tell, as with countless other thousands who have gone before me down the left-hand path to alcohol oblivion. I came finally to the jumping-off place and could not turn back. It was midsummer, 1934. At a New York hospital for alcoholics, I was lying on one of those green beds of physical and mental anguish we AAs know so well. I had been there before, but this time it was different. This time I had no hope
This was the tenant, the cousin, that came to me. What a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my ability, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. So I was soon to plunge out into the dark, joining that endless procession who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and bitter despair I found in that morass of self-search. Quicksand swept around me in all directions. I had met my match. Alcohol was my match. Tense and anxious, my wife Laura sat downstairs with a sassy grip. That kindly man, Dr. William Churchill, and medical saint as ever there was one, was trying in his gentle way to explain my alcoholic dilemma to her. But doctor, she pleaded, tell me, don't spare my feelings, tell me truly, just why can't Bill stop? She had desperately wanted to for these several years. About other things, he always had great willpower and perseverance. He well knows that alcohol means ruin. Oh, tell me the truth, Doc. Why can't he stop? As considerably he could, the good man explained how my drinking, once but a habit, had now become a veritable obsession. How my body, which should once tolerate alcohol, had now become highly sensitized to it. Allergic, he called it. So my dilemma was twofold. An obsession as powerful as that of a kleptomaniac, he seemed. And a physical intolerance to alcohol as grim as that of a diabetic to sugar. The obsession condemned me to drink in spite of myself. My bodily intolerance ensured that I would die or go mad if I kept it up. My only hope, therefore, was the expulsion of my self-destructive obsession, a rare occurrence once it had taken firm hold. At first, the doctor had felt that I might be one of those rare exceptions. But now, seemingly, I was too far gone. I would, he thought, have to be confined somewhere if I were to live very long. That was my sense. Though not told me in so many words, I well knew what it was. I had tried too many times and had failed to walk. I had no more strength to resist. I was through. But it was darkest before dawn. There then came a friend with a message. He was an alcoholic who had been relieved of his obsession. He stood before me as living proof of what he had to say. One alcoholic talking to another. He could convince where others could not. Despite my reluctance, for I was an agnostic, I knew I must heed his message or die. Though not easy to take, his message was simple and direct in the extreme. But within its seeming simplicity, it did carry the miraculous power to expel alcohol obsession and catapult me into a new world. In my case, this occurred the very moment I was willing to lay aside my prejudice, admit my personal helplessness, and try, without reservation, what he offered. So Perhaps this is not the time or place to talk at length of my own recovery, of our AA program in detail, or of our astounding growth. This room is filled with fellow alcoholics who know and practice the AA way of life as well as ours. The accomplishments of Alcoholics Anonymous are headlined in the press of the world. So I should be content if I can remind myself and any who adhere that Alcoholics Anonymous is not, after all, a personal success story. It is, instead, the story of our colossal human failure, now converted into the happiest kind of usefulness by that divine alchemy, the living grace of God. For all those who would know us a little better, or who perchance might wish to try our simple message for themselves, I can do no better than leave with them the last 7 lines of our book of experience, Alcoholics Anonymous. These lines read as follows. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit yourself to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of the past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet more of us as you trudge our road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.